Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up on the program, an analysis of Lebanon's elections and the challenges facing the new government, and turning the tide on polluting the planet's oceans and seas before it's too late. Lebanon's March 14th coalition gets down to business to form a new government after sweeping last weekend's elections. Professor of History at the Lebanese American University in Byblos, Habib Malik, argues that just days before the polls, Hezbollah upped its bellicose rhetoric in an effort to lose the elections. I asked him to explain.
Somewhere, Hezbollah may have concluded that it is safer and better for them to actually remain in the opposition. It's less of a burden, and they're less in the limelight, and not so much subject to, being accused of essentially running or monopolizing the Lebanese government. So that was my feeling, and then the repercussions of those public statements by Hezbollah in the ranks of their Christian partners, namely the followers of General Aoun, Michel Aoun, were very negative, and that weakened Aoun. And so one wonders if Hezbollah also wanted a kind of strong Christian partner to emerge from these elections. But I should also add that it's not just Hezbollah. It's a much, much broader coalition that was out to weaken General Aoun and the policy line that he stands for.
Christians went into these elections, as we've been saying, very divided between those who were allied with Hezbollah, like General Michel Aoun, and those who were allied with the Saad Hariri camp March 14th. How did Christians come out of these elections?
Well, the divisions you mentioned are absolutely accurate, and that, in fact, leads me to characterize the elections that just ended in Lebanon as really a contest between two sets of fears. On the one hand, because really the only contest, electoral contest that occurred, did occur in Christian areas. In the Sunni and Shiite areas, the results were pretty much known in advance. There was no real contest there. But the actual competition occurred in Christian areas. And there, I think, what was at stake was two sets of rival fears. The March 14 group played up the fear of Hezbollah and the fear of Hezbollah's arms, its Iranian connections, its desire to turn Lebanon into a confrontation state, etc., etc. And that, as I said, Hezbollah's public statements the last 10 days before the elections actually played into that and heightened those fears. So that's one set of fears. Another set of fears that the opposition to the March 14 played up was fears of naturalizing 400,000-plus Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, the vast majority of whom are Sunni Muslims. You know, with all that that entails in terms of strengthening the Sunnis, strengthening Saudi Arabia's hand here, strengthening perhaps Wahhabism, which is the radical version of Sunni Islam, as opposed to all the fears from Iran and the radicalism of the Shiites. So there were two sets of opposing fears tugging at the Christians, and the results show that the fears of Hezbollah prevailed over the fears of naturalizing the Palestinians and upsetting the delicate demographic balance. That's the way I would read it in terms of where the Christians ended up with the results. You're right about saying the Christians entered these elections divided. They emerged from these elections still divided. One thing that has happened, General Aoun may still have more or less the same numbers of parliamentary seats that he had before the elections, but he will now be deprived of being able to claim that he speaks for a majority Christian voice in the parliament.
How are the elections being regarded by Lebanon's neighbors, Syria and Israel?
Well, I think starting with Israel, we heard a lot of saber rattling from Israel before the elections, and I think all of that now needs to subside, because Hezbollah did not prevail, nor did the broader coalition of the opposition of which they were a part, and a new configuration of the internal alliances will have to happen in Lebanon. But what the Israelis and others call the moderate March 14 pro-Western alliance, I think, is the stronger one in Lebanon today. Whether all of this terminology makes any sense, that's a separate issue. But since they are stronger, this should allay some Israeli fears to some extent. Now, as far as Syria is concerned, I think the Syrians never really entertained any kind of return to prominence in Lebanon the way they had it before they exited in 2005. I think they still have their friends and allies in Lebanon, and I think they also are worrying about other issues. Their stalled negotiations with Israel over the Golan, which were brokered by the Turks, their relations with the United States, they have been put on notice as being required to behave, as far as Lebanon is concerned, in order for their relations with the U.S. to improve. So I think they will wait and see and eventually take a position with respect to any emerging new Lebanese political formula. But neither Israel nor Syria right now are in any position to meddle directly in Lebanon.
Some of the challenges, we've mentioned some of them, facing the new parliament will include what to do with Hezbollah's weapons. They are the only militia to retain arms after Lebanon's 15-year war. They argue that they are defending Lebanon from Israel. But hasn't the army regained its authority sufficiently to render an independent militia unnecessary in Lebanon today?
No, that is not a very accurate description of the situation. Because implied in what you're saying is the possibility that one may wish to set the army against Hezbollah in order to take away their weapons. And that is a recipe for utter disaster in Lebanon. And nobody wants that. Neither the March 14 people are going to unleash the army on Hezbollah, nor anybody in the opposition is going to condone that. So that's pretty much a non-starter unless somebody wants to wreck Lebanon. No, I think the issue of the arms of Hezbollah will certainly remain. And it'll be a thorny issue. And its solution before the elections, as well as after the elections, is not a Lebanese solution. It's a regional and international solution. It has to probably await some kind of deal emerging from a rapprochement between Washington and Tehran. And that's the only conceivable way in which Hezbollah's arms would be somehow dealt with or neutralized. Unleashing the Lebanese army is suicide for Lebanon. Attacking Hezbollah from the outside, as happened in 2006 by Israel, is not in the cards today because I think both sides, Hezbollah and Israel, are deterred offensively. I mean, Hezbollah has a defensive capability, but will not provoke Israel and will not give Israel a pretext to attack. And I think the Israelis want one less headache and are not interested in going for another repeat of the 2006 adventure, which was inconclusive. So really, any solution for Hezbollah's arms is not going to happen through internal dialogue, as we have seen in Lebanon before. That internal dialogue is useful, I think, but for other reasons. It gets people together, they flesh out issues, they give the appearance that they're compromising and so forth. All of that makes sense in the, you know, in the complicated choreography of Lebanese politics, but it's not going to resolve the issue of Hezbollah's arms. That is only going to occur when something happens regionally and internationally between the United States and Iran. And I think they're trying to position themselves in the present complicated Lebanese formula so that they can retain their arms and their strength until some kind of a larger deal or grand bargain occurs, and then they'll have to play by those rules.
Another challenge is Lebanon's relationship with Syria, which held the reins in Lebanon for three decades and has been blamed by some for the 2005 assassination of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. What is the status now of diplomatic relations between the two countries?
Well, there has been, for the first time ever, an exchange of ambassadors between Damascus and Beirut. And the embassies are opened, and there are now functioning diplomatic relations between the two countries, which never happened before. So that, in a sense, marks a new departure in Syria's relations with Lebanon in terms of international diplomacy. Now Syria officially recognizes Lebanon's independence as a sovereign country. Before, all of this was very ambiguous, vague territory, subsumed under grandiose language of brotherhood and proximity and special relationship, etc., all of these terms which really amounted to fig leaves for Syrian domination. Right now we have official diplomatic channels, and I think this is good and an important improvement. The other thing I would say is that the Syrian departure from Lebanon, April 26, 2005, the departure of their physical visible presence, namely their army from Lebanon, that's not about to be reversed anytime soon. I don't think the Syrians are going to be sending their army back into Lebanon anytime soon under any circumstances. That doesn't mean, however, that Syria doesn't have friends and allies and influence in Lebanon. Of course it does. That will continue. But the Syrians, I think, will take a wait-and-see attitude right now in order to see the kind of political alliances that emerge, and they'll try to play on the internal contradictions of those alliances to strengthen their hand internally, which is a very familiar game that has been played in the past. But it's all now being done, you know, sort of under the watchful eye of official diplomatic recognition and the acceptance of that by the international community.
Another outstanding issue, of course, between Syria and Lebanon is the demarcation of the border between the two countries, and in particular, ownership of the Sheba Farms area in southern Lebanon on the frontier with Israel. Why such foot dragging to arrive at a final demarcation?
Well, because the Syrians, once they do officially sign a recognition by them at the United Nations that the Sheba Farms are, in fact, Lebanese territory, they've said that orally, but they haven't committed that on paper to the United Nations. Once they do that, then an avenue for a diplomatic solution of the Sheba problem will be opened, and negotiations could lead to Israel yielding the Sheba Farms to the UN, and then from there, the UN could run the area until the issue of final ownership of those farms is resolved between Syria and Lebanon. Now, this is one avenue that would diffuse a lot of the tension, but it would mean that Syria has turned its back on its principal ally in Lebanon, namely Hezbollah, whose arms and whose whole resistance posture reduces itself to date pretty much to liberating Sheba and stopping the Israeli overflight and liberating the regions in Kfar Shuba, around Sheba. So if you set that problem on a diplomatic track of solution, you're basically undercutting your own ally in Lebanon. I don't think the Syrians are in a great hurry to lose one of their principal cards, which would be their relations with Hezbollah. On the relations of Lebanon and Syria, I mean, there are many issues still. There is that porous border, the long border between Lebanon and Syria, which needs to be controlled for smuggling and other purposes. There is the issue of Lebanese prisoners, some say in the thousands, but certainly in the hundreds, that are still languishing in Syrian prisons and whose status is unknown at this point. So that needs to be resolved as well. So there are many issues between Lebanon and Syria. The diplomatic relations are an encouraging step. And let's see if the new government that emerges in Lebanon now with the March 14 majority, if it's going to be able to make any headway with the Syrians on these thorny, outstanding issues.
Dr. Habib Malik is a professor of history at the Lebanese American University in Byblos. There's so much of them that we mostly take them for granted. But a growing number of people say we can't afford to do that anymore. The world's oceans and seas are in danger, and the danger is thanks to us.
We're now looking at widespread contamination throughout the marine environment. Even in the most remote areas of the Arctic and Antarctic, you can find some of these industrial chemicals turning up in the sediments, in the water, and in the fish and other species that live there.
We've really got to take stock of what we're doing in our world, in our oceans especially, for our future generations, because this is a beautiful world and we're ruining it. We're just vandals.
Our seas and oceans absorb tons of pollutants every year. And if we fail to turn the tide, our failures will come back to haunt us. One environmentalist website I saw recently had a phrase that really struck me. Sea dumping exists as a result of the misconception that the ocean is big enough to be unaffected by anything that we could do. How big a misconception is it? Well, I asked Dr. David Santillo, a marine biologist and chemist who works as a senior scientist at Greenpeace Research Laboratories at the UK's University of Exeter.
It is a very big misconception, and it's something which really underpins people's approaches to waste disposal using the oceans in previous decades. The idea that it was out of sight, out of mind, that the oceans had a huge capacity to assimilate our waste really drove the development of early controls on environmental pollution. And for many chemicals, which simply don't disappear, they're not assimilated, they build back up again through the food chain. It's simply not an approach to pollution management that has any basis in environmental protection.
What is the kind of waste that unfortunately we're finding in our seas and oceans and even in rivers today?
The types of waste that are currently polluting our rivers and our oceans is a huge variety of different chemicals. Some of the most problematic ones are things like heavy metals, lead and cadmium and mercury, but also some very persistent organic chemicals, things like pesticides, industrial chemicals that really aren't broken down when they're released to the environment. And as a result, they can travel over very large distances. Once they're discharged or dumped in the sea, they can get into marine life and build up in the body tissues of those organisms and into fish. And ultimately, we end up getting the pollution back because what we're doing, in effect, is contaminating the marine food chain. And that's a food chain, obviously, that that we rely upon right around the world.
What are the primary sources, then, of the pollutants that we're finding in the seas and oceans?
There are many, many different sources of marine pollution. Those can be direct discharges of waste from industries located around the coast. They can also be a result of those same chemicals being discharged into river systems. You know, water has been seen for many, many generations as a very convenient way of getting rid of our waste. And although it takes the waste away from the immediate area of discharge, we end up with problems occurring in the sea. But it's not just about point sources of pollution. There are a lot of what are called diffuse sources that can include runoff from agricultural fields, runoff from urban areas in cities, sewage pollution, all kinds of sources of contamination. Because we've been very poor over the years in managing those wastes, and it's been too convenient to see the sea as a great place to dump all the things that we don't want. And I think it's only really been in the last 15 or 20 years that we've come to a realization of what the consequences of that mismanagement of chemicals has been, that we're now looking at widespread contamination throughout the marine environment. Even in the most remote areas of the Arctic and Antarctic, you can find some of these industrial chemicals turning up in the sediments, in the water, and in the fish and other species that live there.
I was reading that actually one of the main components of plastic has been found to affect estrogen levels in humans and animals and, of course, in fish. How is that affecting the fish population?
It's very difficult to say how any particular chemical is impacting on fish populations in the marine environment. I think the difficulty here is that just as it is very complex to describe marine pollution to a full extent because of the huge variety of chemicals that are involved, you know, the differences from one location to another, it becomes even more difficult when you then start to look at what the effects of that will be on any particular species or on marine ecosystems overall. Assessments tend to focus on one chemical at a time, and there have been reassurances given in the past that certain chemicals are present, but present at levels that are unlikely to affect certain species. The difficulty, of course, is that no species is exposed to one chemical at a time. There's always that cocktail effect, that cocktail of chemicals out into the environment. Predicting the effects of those can be very difficult. But you're right, there are concerns over some of the polluting chemicals being able to interfere on a very fundamental level with hormone communication, with reproductive development, with resistance to disease in all types of marine animals, and that is a huge concern.
70% of the world's surface is covered by ocean. That's a huge area.
Australia's Ted Richardson is regional coordinator for Oceania for the Church's Apostleship of the Sea. He's concerned that sea dumping and chemical runoff are a recipe for disaster, and not just for marine life.
We do a great deal of harm. So that mindset of the people think, oh, it's just in that spot. It doesn't stay in that spot. It travels everywhere. It travels through the whole food chain. And eventually we pick it up and we get the remnants of the dumping of the rubbish. You know, we recycle that rubbish through our bodies. And it's just not a good environment to be doing that sort of thing in. We should not use the sea as our own dumping ground in our backyards.
Now, I think everybody has pretty clear in their minds those images that we've all seen on television when there's a huge oil spill of birds and fish covered in that slick black oil. However, There are a lot of invisible things that have been dumped into our oceans that we don't see. I'm thinking of the chemicals, even nuclear waste.
Yes, it's an incredible amount. Even it's the Second World War, dumping, I think the website I looked at had something like 200,000 tons of chemical weapons dumped at sea. That's mustard gas and all these blistering agents just dumped in barrels. In some cases, they had so much of it, they put it inside Liberty ships and just sunk the ships. In one case, the Americans, just off the coast of Florida, decided, you know, the drums didn't sink, so they got guns out and they shot holes in the drums so they'd sink. What happened to the chemicals? Where did they go? You put a hole in the drum, the chemical's going to leach out. Yeah, all these things are rusting, corroding away. There's something like 97 nuclear weapons sitting at the bottom of the sea, just corroding and rotting away. There's 9 nuclear reactors sitting at the bottom of the sea, rotting away, waiting to leak out. This is an environmental catastrophe just waiting to happen. And we're not doing anything about it. We're not doing anything about cleaning it up and going back to that environment and saying, OK, let's tidy it up and get rid of this stuff. We're just leaving it there. And eventually we're going to pay the price of that, that destruction.
To your knowledge, where are many of these dumping grounds?
All over the world, the around the UK, the Channel Islands, through Russia, in the Baltic Sea, off the coast of America, the Pacific Island, Pacific region, just about anywhere where they can find a nice deep hole, that's where it all goes. And they think if it's just deep enough, it's far enough away that we can't be affected by it. And in truth, we're going to be very much affected by it. That stuff will just travel anywhere. As long as water and currents move, we will get it.
There is evidence that some of those containers of munitions, of chemical weapons, are beginning to leak. There have been cases where chemical weapons have even been washed up on beaches or fished up in nets by trawlers. So this is a long-term legacy. And I think that all we can do is try our best to document where these things are, where possible to recover, to retrieve those and make them safe, but also more broadly to learn the lesson of just what happens when we use the marine environment as a dumping ground. And this, what we're doing now, could have consequences for generations to come, just as those deliberately dumped weapons and munitions are having for us now. We need to have better and better information on the extent of marine pollution. And that's true whether we're talking about wastes that have been deliberately dumped or whether we're talking about ongoing sources of pollution. We need to have a much clearer understanding as to what the effects and the consequences are on marine environment and also on our own use of marine resources. But at the same time, documenting pollution won't resolve the problem. And what we need is a far greater focus on dealing with pollution problems as far upstream as possible. We can no longer rely on the seas to take away our pollution and to in some way assimilate it or deal with it so that it can be out of sight, out of mind. Unless we look at the production processes themselves, unless we look at the sources of that pollution and try to address those as far as possible, we're not going to solve the problem of marine pollution, and it's going to be there for our children and our grandchildren to deal with in the future. And really, we cannot miss this responsibility.
Yeah, one thing we haven't talked really about is cleaning up all of the mess.
The problem with marine pollution is that it becomes very difficult to try and remediate the problem once you've caused it. So once chemicals are released in the marine environment, the genie is really out of the box. And although there are such situations where it is possible to clean up very restricted areas that perhaps have been impacted by an oil spill or a particular chemical spill, cleaning up marine pollution more generally simply isn't an option. So the only real way, the only sustainable way of dealing with marine pollution is to deal with the problem at source by stopping that pollution going in the first place. And that needs better regulation on dumping of waste from ships, a better regulation of discharge of waste from onshore facilities, better regulation of the oil and gas industry, which is also a significant source of marine pollution in some areas. And until we get that right, we're simply going to be adding to the problem that's already there.
We already suffer from overfishing in the world's fleets. We're fishing more out of the sea than ever before. So the numbers of fish are declining. And then now that they're getting all these chemicals as well into the fish chain and the food chain, I don't think the future, the way we're going, is going to be very bright for a seafood industry or for ourselves. We've really got to take stock of what we're doing in our world, in our oceans especially, for our future generations, because this is a beautiful world and we're ruining it. Governments really have to step back and say, why are we carrying this stuff to the sea? Why are we sending all these nuclear weapons all over the place on ships? Are we that afraid now that there's going to be a nuclear attack on somebody that we have to have all these nuclear bombs and weapons on submarines that sink and are left to corrode and rot away at the bottom of the ocean that 2, 3, 4 generations from now we'll start to feel the effects of? I think we owe it to our future generations not to let that happen.
We as individuals may not be able to do much about preventing chemicals from entering the marine environment, but we certainly can do more to keep our waters clean. What does the church say is the individual's responsibility to protect the environment?
Well, the church says that we are stewards of our environment, and to be a good steward means that we do look after it, we do care about it. It's the people who just throw their rubbish, not so much directly into the sea, but they'll throw it into creeks and into things that feed into the sea. And it gets washed down. We get the heavy rains and it just floods out and down it goes. There are plastics and plastic bottles and things that fish get stuck in. And as you say, toilet seats and toilet bowls and old boots and anything that gets chucked down into what they call maybe their own farm landfill site, it'll get washed away and eventually it'll work its way into the sea. And then, lovely people go around and clean up those beaches, and they shouldn't have to do that. Because if we all stop and think about where we're putting our garbage, what we're doing with our garbage, how are we recycling that garbage? Are we recycling it, in fact? Or are we just letting the environment deal with it? And the environment only has one way. It's everything goes into the sea. And, again, we end up having these messy, horrible beaches, and if people didn't clean them up, imagine what they would look like in a few years' time. Nobody would want to go there. Nobody would want to even try and walk along the beach because they'd be stepping over all everybody else's rubbish. Even our landfill sites and garbage tips, we need to recycle as much as we possibly can. There's a lot there that can be recycled. A lot of green waste and a lot of plastics can be recycled. We're still not getting the message about recycling all of those things. We're just throwing them away. We've got a motto in Australia, and it just says, don't destroy what you come to enjoy. And if you enjoy the seaside, if you enjoy the beach and the sea, don't destroy it. Look after it. Think about what you're doing before you do it. Say, if I throw this away here, where is it going to go? Where's the cigarette butt that I throw in the street going to finish up? It's the toxic chemicals in the cigarette butt that gets washed out the drains and out into the sea. We have to take a better view on what we're doing with the environment, or, as I say, we're going to pay the price. Well, our next generation will, our children will.
Ted Richardson is regional coordinator for the Church's Apostleship of the Sea in Oceania. And earlier you heard Dr. David Santillo, senior scientist and biologist at Greenpeace Laboratories at the University of Exeter. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.